This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And today we will be plucking from the press the usual crop of fascinating objects, old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not, as our mantra goes. We've got a lot on museums and galleries, etc. Australia's first on the world scene, issues of restitution, and a sad loss to the industry. Stay tuned. And let's kick off with some rugby. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 9th of March. Sport shirts score at auction houses. A 1905 All Blacks shirt worn during the first rugby union test match to be held in New Zealand between the All Blacks and Australia, won 14-3 by the hosts, sold just below top estimate at £39,000 at Welsh sale room Roger Jones, 18% buyer's premium including VAT, on March the 1st. The wearer was fullback Hubert Sidney Jum Turtle, 1880 to 1918. He received just one All Black cap before switching to play rugby league for the New Zealand team dubbed All Golds. Born in London but raised in Christchurch, he later returned to Britain and played for St Helens Rugby League Club. He was killed in the First World War. The shirt came from associated items, including Turtle's All Blacks cap. In October 2015, the New Zealand rugby shirt worn by Captain Dave Gallagher on their 1905-06 British tour made £180,000 at Roger Jones, an auction record. That tour was the first for a New Zealand rugby union team outside Australasia to the British Isles, France and the US. For the first time, the nickname the All Blacks was used by the British press. Now that's certainly a very impressive price. And we'll move from New Zealand rugby shirts sold in England to padlocks sold in Europe. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 30th of March 2019. Padlocks secure high prices. Two iron padlocks caught the eye of numerous bidders at the February the 28th sale at Wendell, that's 18% buyer's premium, at Rudolstadt. They'd both been consigned by an aristocratic family in Franconia, were described as possibly 16th century, and were probably intended for use on castles or town gates. The first was stamped in several places with the letter S under a Greek cross and was 7 inches high. It came with its original key and was in good working order. The bidding started at €240, and in next to no time the successful buyer closed proceedings at €3,000, that's £2,610. The following lot was somewhat smaller and could be dated to the same period. It had the added attraction of a metal plate covering the keyhole, so-called Vexierplatte, an extra mechanism which had to be released before the keyhole could be accessed. It too came with its original key, and even though the mechanism was somewhat stiff, the bids also went to €3,000, that's £2,610. Both lots went to an Italian collector. Let's hope they were secure investments. Now this next piece also comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 30th of March, and one has to say it's almost bizarre. One of 57 varieties, the solid gold bean. Food manufacturer Heinz has paid a hammer price of £750 at auction for a special issue 18-carat gold baked bean. The gold bean was one of 100 hidden in random tins in 1995 as a marketing gimmick called the Golden Bonanza to mark the brand's centenary. The bean was sold with a presentation box and letter referring to the number 57 Heinz Varieties limited edition bean that had been posted to the vendor by Heinz following the win. The bean, stamped Heinz, is number 90 of 100 and had been estimated at £450 to £650 at McTeers, with 24% buyer's premium, in Glasgow on March the 15th. Heinz, via a telephone bid, bought the item as it had not kept an example of the bean in 1995. Heinz marketing manager Fabio Megid Pinto said it is the firm's 150th anniversary and this wonderful piece of memorabilia will take pride of place in our Beansy archive collection. And thank you, Antiques Trade Gazette, for spilling the beans on that story. And now for something completely different. You may have heard about duets on pianos, but how about duels between pianos? Who on the first fleet to Australia in 1788 was tinkling the ivories? Well, this piece comes from Tim Barlas in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 14th of April. Discord over rival claims to ownership of First Fleet piano. When the First Fleet arrived in Sydney in 1788, there was a piano on the flagship HMS Sirius, owned by surgeon George Wargan. A piano claimed to be the First Fleet piano was last month flown back to England for refurbishment, and there are rumours it may be played before the Queen. Step forward a Sydney collector with a very similar piano who believes he has the First Fleet piano in his living room. Both pianos passed through the hands of the same Sydney antiques dealer, and both are said to have been discovered languishing in the laundry of a private home. One, a Longman and Broderip square piano, is an unplayable condition at a house in Queen's Park. The owner, Brian Barrow, purchased it from well-known Woollahra antiques dealer Bill Bradshaw in 1969. The other, a Frederick Beck square piano, actually rectangular, was donated to the Edith Cowan University in Perth in 2016. 3 weeks ago, it was flown back to England to media fanfare for refurbishment and welcomed at a gala event at Australia House. What isn't disputed is that on January the 26th, 1788, a piano, manufacturer unknown, arrived at Sydney Cove. It belonged to surgeon George Wargan, who taught Elizabeth MacArthur, wife of wool pioneer John MacArthur, to tinkle the ivories. She learnt God Save the King and Foote's Minuet. Wargan departed the colony and gave the piano to Elizabeth MacArthur. The MacArthur family moved to Elizabeth Farm in Parramatta in 1793. The piano accompanied them. To 2016, and the Edith Cowan University, of which concert pianist Geoffrey Lancaster is professor of music, spoke of its latest acquisition. It was, it said, Australia's first piano that arrived on the Sirius with the First Fleet. It was among 130 instruments donated by Stuart Simons, a Sydney collector. He purchased the instrument in 1986 from antiques dealer William Bradshaw, the same Mr. Bradshaw who sold the other piano. The media release said Bradshaw reported buying the piano from a home in Windsor on the outskirts of Sydney, where it had sat unloved in the laundry of a family that had owned it since 1830. The procurement of the First Fleet piano and the Stuart Simons collection was facilitated by Professor Geoffrey Lancaster after working closely with Mr. Simons to research his two-volume book, The First Fleet Piano, A Musician's View. Professor Lancaster, however, does write in the conclusion of his book, "From the foregoing pages, it may be conjectured that the Frederick Beck square piano of 1780 to 86 was brought to Botany Bay on board the flagship of the First Fleet, the Sirius, by surgeon George Wargan. Even if it is later found that this particular piano did not arrive with the First Fleet, the existence in Australia of an instrument by Frederick Beck represents a unique part of the nation's heritage." The Queen's Park owner, Mr. Barrow, said his square piano was thrown in as a sweetener on the side when he purchased an orchestrelle piano from Mr. Bradshaw. "It was a wreck," he said. He told me it was allegedly the first Fleet piano because the Matthews family from whom he bought it said the only reason they kept it was because it was Elizabeth MacArthur's. They had it for a couple of generations at least, this may sound familiar, in the laundry. And Bill bought it and sold it to me alongside the orchestrel. The surgeon's father, John Wargan, was a doctor of music. Longman and Broderip set up at Cheapside, near St. Paul's Cathedral, as music sellers and later piano makers. Mr. Barrow added, it wouldn't be surprising if that piano had been given to them, the Wargan family, to demonstrate because it was a new thing at the time. Mr. Bradshaw told me the piano was allegedly the first Fleet piano because the Matthews family from Parramatta, from whom he bought it, said the only reason they kept it was because it was Elizabeth MacArthur's, and they had had it for a couple of generations at least in the laundry. Mr. Barrow has a document signed by the dealer in 2007 where he says in more than 60 years he has not come across another piano more likely to be the first piano in the colony. An ECU spokesperson said, Professor Geoffrey Lancaster is a recognised expert on historical pianos in Australia. He is the author of an extensive and rigorously researched two-volume book on the subject of the First Fleet piano, published in 2015, after 7 years of investigation. In this work, he outlines the available evidence, which indicates the 1780 Beck piano, square piano, as being the first true First Fleet piano. As a university, we welcome healthy academic debate on this topic, but unless compelling evidence to the contrary can be produced, our position is unchanged. I suppose it's not altogether surprising there was a piano on the First Fleet in the days before television, and with no cinemas or theatres or other evening entertainment available to the minders. The convicts, of course, would have had an early night without any evening entertainment.
You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network.
Let's move now on to museums and galleries. Australian museums and galleries don't often hit the world stage in first place. Last July-August issue of the Art newspaper ran a headline about the Powerhouse Museum, now the Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences, in relation to its planned relocation to Parramatta. And the headline read, $890 million Sydney Museum move could be most expensive gallery relocation in history. Critics fear that that plan will lead to parts of the Powerhouse Museum's collection being sold off. And that was written by Tim Stone. $890 million US is, of course, $1.2 billion Australian dollars. But now for another world first for an Australian museum or gallery. And this comes from the Sydney Morning Herald on the 8th of April. And Helen Pitt writes, MCA tops most visited museum list. Sydney's Museum of Contemporary Art has just been named the world's most visited contemporary art museum, according to the prestigious international industry publication, The Art Newspaper. In its annual attendance figures edition, the London and New York-based publication found the MCA last year came in at the top of its category of institutions focused only on contemporary art, with almost 1.1 million visitors annually since 2015. This surpassed contemporary-only art museums in bigger cities such as the Serpentine Galleries in London, 770,000 across two venues, and the Ohlins Centre in Beijing, 905,000, the report said. It also received three times as many visitors in other contemporary-only museums, such as the New Museum in New York, the MCA Chicago, and the Hammer and MoCA in Los Angeles, which all received fewer than 350,000 visitors in 2018. This is a far cry from 20 years ago when the MCA looked like it would go bankrupt in 1999 because it was attracting fewer than 100,000 people annually in its 1939-designed former Maritime Services Board headquarters. Of the MCA's visitors, 40% are international and 46% are aged between 20 and 34, the report on 2018 attendance figures found. While its location in Circular Quay has attracted tourists, the chairman of MCA Board, Simon Mordant, says its free entry and art education programs also helped. When the current director, Elizabeth Ann McGregor, arrived and suggested lifting the admissions charge, the board was at first dismayed, he said, but she found a sponsor to replace the admission charge, and once it was gone, we saw admissions begin to climb to 500,000 in 2010, and in 2012 our audience doubled when we expanded. Mr. Mordant, who also sits on the board of MoMA PSI in New York and MoCA Los Angeles, is such a believer in free admission to museums he advocated for the policy at PSI, resulting in free admission to New Yorkers. Ms. McGregor says the museum has worked hard to create a welcoming atmosphere from designing easy-to-understand art labels written by curators who purposefully do not have higher art degrees to demystifying the concept of modern art. One thing I learnt during my career as a bus driver, taking contemporary art on tour around Scotland, was you need to make people not feel intimidated by contemporary art. We worked hard to challenge the idea that contemporary art is only for the elite, she said. Coupled with the museum's expansion program, she said its education programs, ranging from art classes for children under age 5 to its adults with Alzheimer's and dementia programs, have been crucial to the museum's improved attendance. Ms. McGregor said the museum's peer education program in 15 schools included some in Campbelltown, coupled with its work on creating a safe space for LGBTQI students, had been among the reasons for its improved patronage from young suburban art lovers. People forget there is now a generation of Sydneysiders who've grown up with the MCA, and young people are very open to ideas of contemporary art and sharing it on social media, she said. Well done, MCA, and thank you, Helen Pitt, for your article in the Sydney Morning Herald. I'd like to turn now to the question of restitution. And let's start off this contentious topic with something from the Art newspaper of February 2019 on page 13. Ivan the Terrible returns to Ukraine. A 1911 oil painting of Ivan the Terrible on horseback fleeing the Kremlin that was stolen from Nazi-occupied Ukraine during the Second World War and turned up in the US is on its way back home. For decades, the work hung in a house in Ridgefield, Connecticut, purchased by David and Gabby Tracy in 1987. The previous owner told them the painting was there when the residence was bought from a Swiss man in 1962. Last year, the couple decided to sell the painting, Mikhail N. Panin's Secret Departure of Ivan the Terrible, before the Oprichnina, and sent it to the Potomac Company, an auction house in Alexandria, Virginia. The company valued it at about $5,000, but it never went under the hammer. Our researchers discovered the painting had been exhibited in a museum in the Ukraine at one time and was assumed to have been destroyed, says the company's owner and chief executive, Elizabeth Weinstein. But we contacted the Dnipropetrovsk Art Museum and learned it had actually been stolen by the Nazis. Weinstein called the FBI, which is now working to return the painting to the museum, with the help of the Tracys, who say they're glad it's returning home. For now, the work remains in the US. And now to see just how complex the restitution issue is, we go to the Art newspaper of February 2019 with an article by Jane Callier, art dealer, curator and author, Holocaust-era art restitution more complex than you think. 20 years after the Washington Principles on Nazi confiscated art were endorsed, we've reached a crossroads when it comes to Holocaust-related restitution. I helped bring this issue to light in 1998 when I gave the New York Times correspondence describing the Nazi theft of Egon Schiele's portrait of Wally in 1912, then on loan to Vienna's Leopold Museum, to the Museum of Modern Art. The resulting furore prompted Austria to pass groundbreaking legislation mandating the return of Nazi-looted art in state collections. Now, Nazi-looted art has become a journalistic catchphrase frequently applied with scant basis, in fact. In November 2013, newspapers and magazines around the world trumpeted the discovery of 1,500 Nazi-looted artworks by the German dealer Hildebrand Gurlitt. None of this was true. Much of Gurlitt's art had been purchased legally, and the remainder comprised chiefly works on paper of little value. In the end, the case led to the restitution of just 6 paintings, the discovery at least 1 fake and a great deal of ambiguity. Many works of art do not have complete provenance, particularly drawings, watercolours and prints. Even if we determine that a persecuted collector owned a particular work in 1925, that does not mean he or she still owned it when the Nazis came to power. Art transactions were not always recorded, and the circumstances of persecution, emigration, and the war itself caused a lot of paperwork to be lost or destroyed. Therefore, the rush to judgment can lead to errors, as happened in 2000 when Austria restituted Gustav Klimt's apple tree to, 1916, to the wrong family. Given that with time evidence vanishes and witnesses die, all Western nations impose some form of limitations on theft claims. Yet since many Holocaust claims would be time-barred under existing statutes, claimant advocates tend to recommend suspending the standard limitations. Unfortunately, this often means that works are judged guilty until proven innocent. No one would disagree that restitution should be made when there is compelling evidence of Nazi theft, but sometimes the surviving evidence is inconclusive, and people who purchased in good faith art that previously changed hands without protest have the right to be heard. Back in 1998, Tom L. Freudenheim, then executive director of the YIVO Institute of Jewish Research in New York, warned that Holocaust-related art restitution was becoming a playground for ambitious politicians, hungry lawyers, and sleuthing journalists. "I fear a new era of witch hunts," he wrote in Art News, "in which individual profit motives overtake our understanding of the real issues, the massacre of millions of human beings. What happened to those millions can never be made good. When it comes to Holocaust-era art restitution, it's wise to remember that 2 wrongs do not make a right." And that was Jane Callier writing in the February issue of the Art newspaper, summarising a fairly complex issue. And we now move to the Australian newspaper on Monday the 8th of April with the sad news of the loss of one of the beacons of the industry, both antiques and museum. And this piece is written by Julian Bickersteth, who is chairman of the David Roche Foundation, and Robert Reason, who is senior curator at the foundation. "Antiques dealer helped to create world-class private collection of European decorative arts. Martin Cook travelled the globe for the best pieces." Martin Cook, who has died from a heart attack, was the last surviving and perhaps most influential of the antiques dealer czars who graced Queen Street, Willara, during the latter decades of the 20th century in Australia. When antiques dealers were a known and recognised part of the art scene, Cook was truly the doyen of them all. Physically impressive, well-connected, he counted royalty, media stars and fabulously wealthy among his friends and clients, and with a near-photographic memory for the provenance of great decorative arts pieces, he charmed all who he met. Cook's first career, with the subject of many a joke by him, was as a hairdresser, where his eastern suburbs client base introduced him to the world of antiques. Cook knew how to work his connections, and this, when combined with his own thirst for learning about and researching antiques, quickly allowed him to expand his antiques business, Martin Cook Antiques, in the early 1980s. It was a time when antiques had a real cachet, and he worked with clients in Australia and internationally to build serious collections. Successful art and antiques dealers needed a mix of knowledge, charm, bravado, and chutzpah, and Cook had all three qualities in droves. Dealers in London, Paris, New York would relish his arrival at their door, always with a client in tow, and he built long-lasting relationships with many of them. In a notoriously competitive industry, there was never a bad word about the well-coiffured Australian, attributing itself to his quiet negotiating skills. Cook's most formidable client was South Australian David Roche, whom he met through a family connection in the Australian canine world during the early 80s. An unlikely start, they would be friends for the next 30 years and assemble Australia's greatest private collection of European decorative arts of the 18th and 19th centuries. Almost daily phone calls and regular visits by Cook to Adelaide led to a friendship united by the desire to buy the best antiques from around the world. While Fermoy House in North Adelaide was the repository, it was the auction catalogues, the faxes, followed by Dave's big shopping list that saw them visit far-flung places and examine exquisite objects. Travel goods and bad times, great friends, those that got away were all part of the shared experience between Cook and Roche. When Roche became unable to travel, Cook continued their work, standing at the famous House of Hanover Sale in the Schloss Marienburg, Germany. Cook was one of the on the phone, trying to calm Roche's nerves, while also listening and bidding at an auction in a foreign language. The result was two highlights of Roche's collection. The David Roche Foundation was established in 1999. When Roche died in 2013, Cook was charged with making his dream of a house museum and gallery a reality. As the foundation's inaugural curator and then museum director, Cook achieved something he believed would make his friend proud. The magnificent museum opened in June 2016, celebrating Roche's home with a changing exhibition space that showcases antiques and decorative arts. Thousands of people have enjoyed what Cook and Roche created, many having been met by Cook at the door and introduced to the collection. Adelaide and Australia have been enriched by Roche's gift to South Australia, and Cook brought it to life with love, wit, humour and hard work. Generous with both his advice, money and friendship, Cook was much loved by his wide band of friends. He was a born raconteur, although it was never entirely clear how much of the story was embellished, and Cook had many stories to tell, but it was always a wonderful and often outrageous story. Valet Martin Cook.
That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.